There are moments in your career when you know in your gut that you have to ace this meeting. The chips are down, and this is the meeting with the person that will change your life forever. What do you do? How do you deal with the nerves? And what if it doesn't work? You're going to find out in this episode of Events That Made Me. This season is all about one of my biggest passions, business. So I've invited some of the UK's biggest and most exciting entrepreneurs to tell me about the events that made them. This is season four, The Entrepreneur's Edit. My guest today is co-founder of Fullwell 73 film and TV production company. You might be more impressed if I tell you he is a 10-time Emmy Award winner and 28-time nominee, holding the record for any individual. He's won an MTV Video Music Award, 3 Brits for directing, 2 PGA Awards, and 5 Critics' Choice Awards. He is the producer of, wait for it, The Friends Reunion, The Grammys, and The Late Late Show with James Corden. And I haven't even mentioned One Direction and the Adele CBS special. May I introduce to you the exceptionally talented Ben Winston.
Hi Liz, how are you?
It's very lovely to be here.
Now, each of my guests gives me 3 events that made them make life-changing decisions. But before we get to those, share with me a little bit about you. I know that you come from a family of high achievers, and your father being the eminent Lord Robert Winston. I mean, did that challenge you? How did you feel about that? I mean, he's a big cheese.
Yeah, he is. I was very aware of it growing up. I was very aware that my dad was different in that people knew who he was. I never felt pressure from him in any way to go into medicine or to study science, or he was always very supportive of anything we all wanted to do. My brother Joel followed in the medical line, but my sister and I both went into TV.
I'm researching this before we chat, and I think to myself, yeah, here is Lord Robert Winston, who pioneered fertility and is a professor, and then all of a sudden he's directing theatre. So you're not going to turn sort of go into gynecology, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm not going to be a gynecologist. No, I think that would be very unlikely.
But it's interesting that one's childhood or one's upbringing has a huge effect, I think, on how we live our lives. And we're both Jewish, and I know that you are very committed to the religion.
Listen, I've never been ashamed of my Judaism. I've never hidden it. I've spoken about it at any opportunity that anybody asks me about it. I think it's strange for people in the industry, maybe, when they hear that I don't like drive on a Saturday and I do my best not to work. And so, yeah, I think that's always an odd thing for people when they invite me out on a Friday night and a Saturday lunch and I can't be there. So I think it's more just that perks their interest, I guess, in it. And again, you know, I guess that also comes a little bit from my father, and he would work every hour of the day, 6 days a week. And then on Friday night and Saturday, he was with us, and it was all about the family, and the patients and the stresses that he would have during the week would all go, and it was just fully focused 25 hours of family time. And I think I'm definitely in an industry where you can sometimes feel like what you're doing is the most important thing, even though it isn't. But with deadlines and showbiz and big name actors and whatever, you can sometimes think, oh my God, this is so important. And it's really nice to be able to Friday night and Saturday just go, no, I'm not doing this for a few days.
It's revealing how Ben talks about his religion and how it gives him a work-life balance. And I refer to that in my air extension after this episode. So tune in and listen. It's entitled Roots. In the Jewish religion, Friday night is the Sabbath. And Ben shares that with his family. It was one of those Friday nights when he was sat with his sister and he had a career-changing decision to make.
What happened was, it was my gap year. I decided to take a gap year after finishing school before I went to Leeds University. And it was a Friday night dinner, and I had 2 offers of what I was going to do for the first sort of part of this year that I was taking off. The second half of the year, I was going to go to Israel for 6 months and work out there with some friends and coach football. And I was definitely doing that from sort of, you know, February onwards. But what was I going to do from September to February? And I had 2 offers. The first offer was working for a football agent, being paid 300 quid a week, But this football agent looked after all of Arsenal, which is my team's biggest stars. Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp, Ian Wright. It looked after all of them. And I was very excited to get this job offer because I'm an Arsenal obsessive. And the idea of working alongside this agent, who I'd worked a little bit with before as well during summer holidays, really excited me. And it was a London job. I'd be able to live at home. I'd have the comforts of staying at my mum and dad's as I lived back then. And then, you know, doing whatever Thierry Henry needed me to do. The other job offer was in television, and it was a 2-week work experience job, unpaid, being a runner, or PA as we call them out in America, where essentially I'd just be getting coffee and delivering scripts and whatever else. And it was a brand new show called Teachers, which no one had heard of. It went on to be a big series, but at the time it was, no one had heard of it. And it was for Channel 4, and it was living in Knowle West in Bristol, which I think at that time had the number one most assaults of anywhere in Britain at the time, was in Knowle West. And I was offered a 2-week unpaid job there, and I had to move to Bristol for it. So I was sort of thinking, well, that doesn't sound so fun. Even though it's in the industry that I want to work in, I don't think that's for me. Whereas I could go and work in this glamorous agent's job. And I remember it was a Friday night, and my sister said to me, well, what have you decided? Are you going to go and work on Teachers, or are you going to go and work for this football agent? And I said, oh, I haven't decided yet, because I knew that she'd think I should go and work on the TV show. And she said, I don't understand why you'd want to go for work for a football agent. You don't want to work in football. You don't want to work as an agent. You want to work in TV. You've got an offer of 2 weeks. Why wouldn't you go and do that? You're just scared to move out of home and move to Bristol and be independent. That's what you should do. And I partly did it because I didn't want to lose face in front of my sister. And I went, okay, fine. I am going to Bristol. I always going to Bristol. Of course I'm going to Bristol. And off I went to Bristol, slightly nervous about what I was getting myself into and turning down this other opportunity. And on my first day there, I was 18 years old, and I met James Corden. And James was 21 at the time. He had a very small part in the show. It was pre-Gavin and Stacey and pre-Fat Friends, which was a huge success for him. And it was, of course, many years before what we did together on The Late Late Show. And we met on that first day and immediately hit it off and became firm friends. And that show, I stayed there for 3 seasons in the end. That 2 weeks turned into 4 months where I was paid. And then I went back for season 2 and season 3 of it. Teachers became a huge show with Andrew Lincoln as the lead, who went on to be Rick Grimes in The Walking Dead and has become one of my closest friends in the world. And on that show, 2 things happened. I made friends for life, and I also moved my way up rapidly through the show. I started as a runner, but then before long, I was an assistant director. And then by the 3rd season, I was directing, producing, and filming all the behind-the-scenes documentaries about Teachers for Channel 4. So it rapidly elevated my career very fast, that show. But more than that, I met James. And James, he became a 5th partner in my company with the other 3 guys I run Fullwell with. I was best man at his wedding, and we are as close as friends could be. And we moved out here 7 years ago, started The Late Late Show. And everything that's happened in my life since then has been because of that relationship. And it's very interesting that that Friday night dinner at my mum and dad's house, when just to save face with my sister, I chose the harder route of going to Bristol and being unpaid, but at least being in the industry I wanted to be in, it without question led to everything that has followed since.
That is
so
amazing.
I definitely look back at that as a sliding doors moment.
100%. And, you know, I am a firm believer in fate, and I think that things take you a longer path for a reason. But I certainly hope that your sister has got a percentage of every single investment and company that you've made, because I think she is key to this entire success story, is Tanya.
She absolutely doesn't have any of the sort. Nothing of the sort.
Winston, that's not fair. That's not fair.
Well, we help each other. We look after each other.
And also, I think chemistry is very important. I know in a very different way, but I've had it with clients. Sometimes you meet a client and there's just no chemistry there, and you know that it's never going to work. And you've got to have big balls to walk away and say, actually, I'm not going to do this gig. So with you and James Corden, there was obviously something there that cemented the relationship that enabled you to both go on a most exciting journey. And I think that is, it's really interesting. Now, the second event is etched in my memory. I thought you never came because you were being an arsehole, because you didn't want to come to Manchester for a Jewish wedding. But I never realised that on the night that my elder daughter got married in 2009, that you were actually doing something really, really exciting. And for those of you listening, I actually know Ben through my daughter and her husband, who are contemporaries of Ben and his wife, Meredith, who's a friend of hers and came to her wedding back then. So tell me.
Yeah, well, when we were, you know, in preparation for this, you asked me to think of three events that had affected my life. And one jumped to mind just because of the relationship with you. So Goldie and Si, Goldie, your daughter, and her husband, Simon, have been friends of mine. I remember Simon coming back from their first date because Simon, her husband, lived with me at university. And so I remember the whole courting stage of Goldie and Si. In fact, I remember Goldie, the first time we met her, she turned up at our house with a box of gingerbread men biscuits. And it worked a treat because she bought her way into our house through our stomachs. And we all immediately loved her because she'd brought cookies to the house. So yeah, we were all at Leeds University together. That's where I met Si. And they became very close friends of Meredith and I. It was the night of their wedding. And I would never usually miss their wedding. I think Si was a groomsman at my wedding. That sort of goes to show how close we were. In fact, no, that he wasn't. Him and Goldie signed the certificate at my wedding. So they were the witnesses at our wedding, Si and Goldie. So that shows you that missing Si and Goldie's wedding on that Sunday night in Manchester, it must have been a big deal. Meredith went on her own. She still talks about how I let her go to a wedding on her own. But yes, that night, James and I had just started working together. And James, again, is involved in this story. And I hadn't directed very much at that stage in my life. It was 2010, wasn't it, when they got married? So
2009.
Oh, okay. So I directed even less. So it's 2009. And I was just sort of starting out as a director. James and I started developing with my partner, Gabe Turner, these ideas for Smithy sketches. Smithy was a character in Gavin and Stacey. And we had these ideas that we could do Smithy sketches for comic relief. And we did Smithy Meets the England Team, where he went and disciplined all the England players. And then we had this big idea that we took to Richard Curtis, who's one of my heroes. And he ran comic relief, still does, I think. And we said, what about Smithy wins coach of the year at Sports Personality of the Year? And he said, I love that idea, but I don't know if Sports Personality of the Year will ever let you film there. It's 13,000 people in Sheffield Arena. They go live at 7 o'clock in the evening. And basically our pitch was to get everybody in their seats at 6:45. And Smithy goes and does his speech, which is essentially a roast to everybody in the audience. He took the piss out of each one of them one by one. And it's worth Googling and YouTubing Smithy Wins Coach of the Year, because it was a huge undertaking. And there was me as a young director. I'd only directed like one thing before. And suddenly I'm stood in Sheffield Arena, 13,000 people, directing this huge sketch with all the biggest sports stars in the world. Fabio Capello at the time was England manager. He was in it. Gary Lineker was in it. Fred Flintoff was in it. And James, basically, we had 9 minutes before the show went live to shoot this sketch. So there was no way I could be anywhere else that night apart from in Sheffield shooting Sports Personality of the Year, because that sketch became massive for us. And it was, you know, a really iconic comic relief sketch. They still replay it on Comic Relief Night. And I think about that night, and I think about, you mentioned events that led to other things or that were significant in your life. I think it was the thing that cemented James and I working together. It was the most ambitious directing job I'd ever done until that point. And of course, you get jobs, you get your next job off the back of how good the last one was. And on top of that, it started relationships with people. David Beckham was in that sketch. Andy Murray was in that sketch. Jenson Button was in that sketch, who at the time was a Formula One world champion. And all of those people we've worked with since in various different ways. You know, Beckham we've done loads with over the years, and Andy Murray we've done the odd thing with, Jensen too, Freddie Flintoff we've done huge documentaries with him. And it all started on that night, being there, cementing my relationship with James as somebody who could produce and direct him, cementing my relationship with the BBC as a director they could trust, and then working with all this talent that has gone on to make other shows with us, from Class of 92 with David Beckham to, you know, a commercial that I shot with Jenson Button a couple of years later. It really led to a lot of stuff that night.
I mean, it's the most amazing story, because it is, you know, whilst you came from a privileged background, you started from nowhere. Do you ever have pinch me moments? Do you ever get starstruck? Or are you always a cool cucumber?
I don't get starstruck apart from with sports stars. I love sports stars. They excite me a lot more than actors or musicians or I have huge respect for talent. So when I say I don't get starstruck, it doesn't mean I don't respect them. I'm in awe of so many people and the ability and the talent that they have. But I don't really, you know, I run a late night show. So we have three guests every day come in and we deal with them every day. And so I definitely have pinch myself moments, for absolute sure. I've been able to do such wonderful things, attend such amazing things. And all the time, my wife and I will like look at each other and go, this is crazy. I don't think anyone would believe the day that we're having here. And so, you know, I definitely have those moments, whether it be sat on the Friends set with the Friends cast directing them, or whether it be we shot something with Tom Cruise recently and he offered to pick us up in his plane to take us there. And we're standing on the tarmac and Tom Cruise lands a plane and we jump on board and fly with him. Like, there are moments that I have to absolutely pinch myself. But I feel very lucky. I feel really like lucky and fortunate. And I'm just trying to sort of enjoy it as much as I can, because it definitely won't last forever. That's for sure.
Tell me about the first ever night of the Late Show. We know how you met James and what it was that connected you. But I want to know about the first ever night of the Late Show.
Yeah, I look back on that night and it was March 23rd, 2015. And it will always be etched in my memory in a way, because it was such a big moment for us. We moved to Los Angeles. James and I, we did that Sports Personality of the Year sketch that I spoke of, and we did one other sketch in 2010. And then we did a TV show for ITV in 2010. But then we didn't work together again for 5 or 6 years. We were great friends. We spent a lot of time together, but he was busy with what he was doing. I was busy with what I was doing. We sort of went our separate ways, and I sort of got very involved with One Direction, and I was directing and producing their videos, their movies, everything like that. I was working with various different artists and talent and whatever. And then I remember I was in town and I was editing one of the One Direction films we made, and he came to visit me and we went out for lunch in Great Portland Street, and he said, look, I've been offered the Late Late Show in America. And I was like, well, that sounds like a terrible idea. I was like, you will hate doing that. And he was like, why would I hate it? I was like, because you love doing a million things. You love doing League of Their Own. You like writing Gavin and Stacey. You enjoyed writing your book. You're about to be on Broadway with a play that he was going to do. You know, he loves doing a bit of everything. I was like, to be stuck to a desk every night, having to do an hour of TV every single night, will kill you. And he said, no, I think you're wrong. He said, I think that if we, and that was the first time he had insinuated that I might be involved in this. He said, if we had a blank piece of paper to fill every single night on the number one network in America, CBS, and every morning we could wake up knowing that we had to do an hour of TV that night, we could make that the most creative thing we ever do. And this doesn't need to be looked at like a talk show, but could be looked at like a variety show. We could sing, dance, sketches, comedy, great interviews. You know, there was a million different things that we could do with this hour. And suddenly I realized, actually, yes, he had the ability to do it, in that he could sing, he could dance, he could act, he could tell jokes, he was interesting and interested, which is always very good for a host to be. So I suddenly realized that this might be something that we should do. Well, we moved out to America and...
Well, so you just packed up and moved out?
Well, no, I didn't pack up. I went for an interview. I had to be interviewed by Les Moonves, who was the boss of the network. But that's a whole different... That's a long story, but I'm happy to tell that story. I just don't know how long you want your podcast.
Yeah, no. I want every story. Every story.
Well, James had set up for me to meet with Les, and he'd obviously said to Leslie, you know, and Leslie at that time was the godfather of television, as powerful a man as you could have in television. This is the guy that ran Warner Brothers when Friends and ER was on the air. He was the one who took over CBS and made it the number one network in America. Like, what Les Moonves said went.
Did you know him before we met?
It's like in my industry, it was like saying, hey, do you know the Queen? Do you know what I mean? Like, Les is the godfather of television. And so James had said to Les's team, I'd like Ben to be the EP. And I think they were thinking, you know, okay, let's meet him. So I got a note from CAA, the agency, that I should fly out to LA to meet Les. And I told Meredith, I said, look, nothing's going to happen here. They're meeting a load of people, but I'm going to go and meet him. And so I flew over. I was really excited. I went, I bought a new jacket. I got my hair cut. I was really excited about meeting Les Moonves for dinner. And I walked into the Sunset Tower, which is still to this day, you know, 8 years on, it's still the hot place in LA, you know, where it's hard to get a table. I remember walking up to the front desk and saying, I'm here to, you know, and the guy not being that interested in me. And then I said, I'm here to have dinner with Les Moonves. And suddenly it was like people like shoved out the way for me to come through. And I marched to Les's table and we sit. And I remember that moment because I felt very embarrassed at that moment because I said hi to Les and I could see that Les couldn't have given two monkeys about me. I'd seen that I'd been naive in that I'd seen in that moment, I think that Les was meeting me because I was James Corden's mate. He wasn't really meeting me because he knew anything about me. And I sort of felt a little bit naive that I'd thought that, you know, maybe I could have got this job. But in those moments, it sort of pushes you, I think, because you're like, you suddenly realize, well, you've got nothing to lose. So all the nerves I had about doing it and whatever else, or having that meeting went because there was no pressure because this guy didn't care two hoots about me. So I went for it and I spoke about why James was the best host possible for that slot, about what that show could be, about why I felt I was best placed to run it. And I just went for it for 45 minutes. I went for it. And at the end of it, he said, I remember, never forget, he said to me, I always knew I had the right man for the show in James Corden. I just didn't know what the show was going to be. And I didn't quite know what that meant. But I also know that James had said to him in advance, you know, had really built me up and had been very lovely about me, as he always is, James. He's, you know, behind so much of the success I've had in my career, I owe to him and his belief in me before anybody else gave two hoots about me. And we got the job. So I went back and I remember I went to the Spaniards Inn in Hampstead and I said to Meredith, we'd just done up our house. We moved into our house when we got married in 2010. We'd moved into our house maybe 2009 and it wasn't great upstairs and we'd spent a hell of a lot of money and we were moved out. We were living with a friend of ours in Hampstead and we were about to move back in finally to our dream home that we'd been building for like 6 months. And I remember I sat with her in Hampstead and I said, look, how would you feel about us moving to LA? Because I've been offered this job to run James's show. And all she went is, what about our house? We've spent so much time on our house. But she was amazing as she always is. And we moved. I moved on December the 28th. Of 2014, and we went live with our show on March the 23rd.
I'm going to chip in here because I think there's a theme developing that's about pressure. Now, clearly, Ben has already faced pressure from his interview with Les, but he managed to overcome that by thinking, well, what have I got to lose? There was so much pressure, it became no pressure because Ben let himself off the hook and was able to speak from the heart with real passion. And I think this is a key skill for an entrepreneur. You need to face that pressure head on all the time. There are too many occasions for me to recall the number of times that I've thought to myself, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? The worst thing that can happen is either the client says no, the venue says I can't, I will never, ever not have enough money to put food on the table, and I will never, ever fail because I'll only ever learn. So Ben has had his interview and he's got the job. And as you'll hear, he used the same technique of taking the pressure off himself so he could perform at his very best to create a hit show right from the start.
And as soon as I got to LA, I realised that the odds were stacked against us. Every article had said, James Corden, who? Every article had said, who are these people running this late night show? And late night television in America is this really iconic format. You know, people talk about Johnny Carson, they talk about David Letterman, they talk about Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Kimmel. There are only five late night shows on network television. You know, there was Jimmy Fallon, Jay Leno. At the time when we were starting, it was Jimmy Fallon and Jay Leno when we were looking at it. They were the two on NBC. There was Jimmy Kimmel on ABC. And then there was David Letterman and Craig Ferguson on CBS. And so those shows never come about. All those guys have been in those jobs for 15, 20 years. Conan, I think, did 30 years. And so it's very rare that those seats change. So when those seats change, there's a lot of attention about it. And the fact that an unknown dude from Britain was coming, who none of them had heard of, also a white male, which didn't excite some members of the media. Plus, he was bringing his 32-year-old best mate with him to produce the show. And I was replacing the previous EP, a guy called Peter LaSalle, who actually is on my wall back there because he's become a picture of him because he's become a mentor of mine. And he was Johnny Carson's producer, David Letterman's producer, Craig Ferguson's producer. He retired at the age of 84. And there was me coming in and taking his office. We immediately felt huge pressure because we knew that if we didn't succeed quickly, we would be off. Because America is different to England. When you succeed, the world is your oyster. If you succeed in America, everybody wants to work with you. The amount of shows we do on different platforms has proven that. But if you fail in America, they get rid of you within a heartbeat. You can be cancelled within 10 shows if you're not making it. Whereas if you do make it, you're good for a while and your career can be expansive. So we were very aware of it. But actually, James and I both thought to ourselves, and I remember we had a conversation one day with Rob Crabb, who we got on board as like the third person in our little boy band, where he became co-EP with me. And we sort of said, you know what, actually, we have no pressure because no one expects us to succeed. America don't know who the hell he is. Britain is used to locals coming over to America and failing. So actually, this is just a Brucey bonus. This is just a, this could be great. But it all came down to that first night, March 23rd, because if you do a good show on March the 23rd, then the reviews are good, the commentary is good, everybody watches a premiere because of all the marketing and advertising that goes to that one first show. You only really have one shot if you're unknown to make an impact. If you're known, if you've been on Saturday Night Live for years or you're a famous comedian, people will give you a bit of time because they're already fans of you. James had no time. If James didn't succeed on that first night, no one was going to watch on the second night and the reviews would have been awful. We would have been dead and buried in 1 hour. And that's how we all felt. So planning that one night was without question the most meticulous thing we ever did. We planned from what James would say when he came out and did that monologue. We planned an opening sketch with cameos from Meryl Streep and Alison Janney and Shia LaBeouf, where we basically hit head on the idea that America was like, how on earth did James Corden get this job? And we did like a Willy Wonka style spoof where Les Moonves was in it and he was giving out Late Late Show chocolate bars and all these people were opening it and they didn't get the golden ticket. And Chelsea Handler, who's a big comedian in America, she was the one who people said was going to be taking over the Late Late Show. And then suddenly it was announced James Corden got it and no one could understand what had happened. They were all like, we thought it was going to be Chelsea Handler, and whether they offered her or they didn't offer her, I'll never know that. But it was definitely lots of articles about the fact that this woman, Chelsea, was going to take over. And so we managed to persuade her to be in the sketch, and she buy, look, Chris Rock and Billy Chris and all these people buy the chocolate bar. They open it. There's no golden ticket. Then she goes to a newsagent. She buys the chocolate bar, and then she gets a phone call and she drops it on the floor, and James Corden walks past and picks it up and goes, excuse me, you've dropped it. And he opens it and there's the golden ticket. So we were very clever about being self-deprecating. And then he gets the golden ticket and he goes to late night school with Jay Leno. And Jay teaches him how to be a late night host. And it was a really big 10-minute sketch. But it immediately showed, A, we do really bold, ambitious things. B, we had some big stars in there. And C, it was self-deprecating and clever. Then we came back to the studio and we managed to get Tom Hanks and Mila Kunis to be our first guests. And we had to beg on that. I remember I had a phone. That was where I was starstruck. I remember I begged Tom Hanks to come on our show. And then we did a 5-minute sketch with him where we recreated his entire film career on a green screen, all in 5 minutes. And that was a big, ambitious sketch that was live in the studio in front of an audience. And then we ended it with James Corden doing a song, which was a really funny, sweet song about, thanks for watching me tonight. I'm going to be here every night. Don't really know what I'm doing, but I'd love you to join me again tomorrow. And it's meant a lot for me. And it was a very poignant, sweet song. So we had come out the traps with a firm, heartfelt, funny monologue. And we left it all out there, as they would say in sport. You know, we left it all out on the court. And we put the show out that night, and I remember I was sat in this office right here, and we taped the show at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then it goes on air in New York at 9:30 or 9 o'clock our time here. So it's midnight there, but it's our time here now. And I remember, although we had to prepare for the second show, I remember just locking my door because I definitely, that was the first time after we'd when we were taping the show, I didn't feel stress. I felt creative buzz, and James did too. We felt full of energy and excitement, and we had to make it happen, and the set had to be ready, and the band had to be on point, and the lighting had to be great. But as soon as we'd finished taping and we'd edited it, it was like, there's nothing I can do now. It's just out there, and hopefully people will watch it, and hopefully people will like it. And so that's the only time I felt real pressure. And so I sat in here and I watched on Twitter as the 9 o'clock taping went out, and I watched people's responses and they were good. And then I stayed in here till midnight and I watched it go out on my TV here. And again, I refreshed Twitter and watched people's responses to it. And then I waited until about 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the morning. And then I sort of sat here and went through emails and thought through the next show. And then about 5 a.m., I was still in this office and the newspapers had come through and the reviews were in and they were great and the ratings was decent too. And the relief I felt in that moment, realizing that we'd done a good job and people liked it, when I started reading these reviews, I felt a huge sense of relief. And I remember I got in my car, I left here about 5 a.m., unlocked that door, went out, went to my car, drove home, got into bed with Mary for like 5 minutes. And she went, "How is it? How is everything okay?" And I went, "Yeah, we're going to be all right. We're going to be okay." And we sort of lay there for like half an hour and chilled. And then I got straight in the shower and I was back here by like 8 o'clock because we had to do another show that day. And so I think about that 24 hours in a big way, because there's still stuff that we do in our show today, whether it be Reggie Watts and the house band that we have here, whether it be the sketches, the bold, ambitious stuff that we were doing with Tom Hanks, the song that James ended with 7 years on. You know, tonight we're going to, oh, we're not on today because it's a Friday, but Monday will be 960 episodes. We'll have done number 960. And so we're still living, number 960 is still living off number one. Because if number one hadn't worked, we wouldn't have made number 14. And so that night was both a beautiful night for all of us and a significant night for everything we're going to go on to do in the future.
And none of this would have happened without that nothing to lose confidence that Ben took with him to meet Les Moonves. I think about the meetings I've had over the years where I've taken the feeling of I have nothing to lose. Classic example was when I was asked to do the opening of the Ivy restaurant in 2018 and I had to go meet the formidable Richard Caring. Sat across the table in silence, he looked at me and he said, "Liz, nothing lasts forever." I took the bull by the horns and I don't know where it came from. I said, "Richard, herpes lasts forever." That was a classic moment, because from that minute, we were best friends. So the thing is, you never know where one meeting is going to take you. Ben's relationship with James is vital to the success of their business. And one of the most successful products of their relationships is the feature Carpool Karaoke. I wanted to know where Carpool Karaoke came from, as they've had so many amazing guests, like Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, that was a big one for us, actually. Carpool was very early on, actually. I think Carpool was on show two. I think the next night we had Carpool Karaoke. It was both of our ideas, in truth. We really struggled to get guests when we first started, because no one knew who James was. No one knew who I was. Everyone's publicist wanted to see if the show was a hit first. And, you know, Britain are used to exporting quite critical people. Simon Cowell is incredible, but at that time he was very much the English critic. Piers Morgan was the English critic. So I think there was a certain amount of, well, we don't know who James Corden is. We don't know if he's going to be kind to our guests or he's going to roast them. So let's wait and see. So we were really struggling to get guests on. And so we had this idea, well, what about if James, and it came from one of those Smithy Comic Relief sketches. If you look at a sketch we did with George Michael, they were singing in a car early on in like 2011, and people really resonated with it. And so we thought, well, we could do that again. And then it's a bit easier ask. We're driving to their house. We're saying, get in the car. We'll drive you around for half an hour and drop you back home. You don't even need to come to our studio. So part of Carpool came out of an ease of how do we get guests to come on our show who wouldn't, which is so ironic because it became the biggest thing in late night. I mean, it's still the number one clip in the history of late night television. And yet it came out of a need because people wouldn't come on our show. And James and I were brainstorming with a whole group of writers. And then we sort of came up with it. And James said, what about we call it Carpool Karaoke? And suddenly it was like, wow, that's it. We've got it. But it took a long time to get people to do it. And luckily, Mariah Carey was our first one. She agreed to do it. And then Stevie Wonder was a turning point too, because as soon as Stevie did it, a lot of legends in the industry who were your Chris Martins, your Adeles, they all felt much more comfortable doing it. Now Stevie Wonder, the godfather of the industry, had done it. And yeah, it became a thing that ultimately ended up selling records for people. You know, people, huge stars like Lady Gaga and Bruno Mars, they would come on because they knew that their album would sell more that night. You know, I remember Lady Gaga, I saw her recently at the Friends thing, because I asked her to come and do the Smelly Cat song on the Friends reunion. And she was so sweet. She said, you know, that Carpool that we had done 3 years before, she goes, that Carpool got me a number one album. And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, well, we were trending at number three going into album release week. And I did Carpool and we got a number one. And she goes, I credit it to that. Now, of course, it was because her music was brilliant and she was singing her brilliant music on the Carpool. But Carpool became a real thing where it could move the needle in song sales. And that is something that's very, very rare in today's very sort of overcrowded, saturated entertainment.
You see, there's a commercial opportunity behind every creative. Tell me about the Friends reunion, because I think that a lot of people want to know that.
Friends reunion, yeah, that was a job of a lifetime, really.
Did they obviously came to you, did they?
They didn't. The cast and the creators didn't. I went to them. No, what happened was I became friendly with a guy at Warner Brothers called Mike Darnell. And Mike runs Unscripted over at Warner Brothers. And we did a show together and we got on really great. And he called me and just said, look, it's the 25-year anniversary of Friends. And no one's really doing anything for it. And would you have any ideas? Now it's the 27th anniversary. It took a long time to get it going because of COVID and whatever else. And I was like, that's really interesting. I'd love to talk about it. And I think the cast and the creators had always said, we'll never do another episode. But if somebody had an idea, we'd be open to something to celebrate the show. So I sat with Kevin Bright, Marta Kaufman and David Crane, who created the show, and had a great meeting with them. And I was really honored to meet them because I always get, you know, you asked me earlier if I get starstruck. I don't get starstruck by meeting famous people, but I do get starstruck by meeting producers and directors that I hugely admire. And those three are them. They are such iconic producers, those guys, after what they did with a show like Friends. And I had a really great meeting with them where they came in quite skeptically and were like, I don't know if we want to do anything. And I put a few ideas together of, like, you know, merging documentary with an entertainment show with a few fun bits and skits and quizzes and fashion shows and table reads and throw the kitchen sink at it. But I had a real plan for it. I really wanted to make it, I don't know if you saw the show, but I really wanted to make it multifaceted. I didn't want it to be just a documentary about them meeting up, but I also didn't want to make it like a talk show, where a chat show where all they're doing is chatting on a couch. So we tried to find loads of different elements, which I think we did. And then I would interweave them so that every bit was linked from one bit to the next. And the creators liked it. And they said, look, we have no idea if the cast would want to do it, but feel free to reach out to them. And I went through David Schwimmer's publicist and I managed to get a FaceTime with him. And we FaceTimed and I pitched him the idea. And he said, look, it sounds really interesting. And he set me up to go to Lisa Kudrow's house. And Lisa she invited Matt LeBlanc and Courtney Cox over. So I went to their house. And by that time, I had like a fleshed out treatment. So I did this presentation for them and they really liked it. Then I met with Matthew Perry over FaceTime and he liked the idea. And then finally, I met Jennifer Aniston in a hotel in LA. We met one night and got on really great and spent an hour or two together discussing what the show could be. And all six of them signed off. Then we obviously had to make a deal and luckily they did. And there it was. And I don't direct everything I produced, but that was one of those things where I was like, this is so massive. This is such a big moment for television, seeing these six people back together, that I decided I would direct it as well, which I rarely do. And it was a job of a lifetime. You know, there is one funny thing to tell you, which is we finally did the deal with them in December 2019 and we were due to shoot in March 2020. We were shooting on like the 22nd or 20th of March 2020. And around 1st of February, Lisa Kudrow called me up and she said, what are we going to do about having a live audience if coronavirus hits America? And I remember thinking, remember, this is early February. No one was talking about coronavirus. Definitely, there might have been a few column inches somewhere, but no one was actually taking it seriously. And Lisa Kudrow called me and I was like, and I remember thinking, wow, Lisa Kudrow is just like Phoebe. She's so out there that like she thinks coronavirus is going to affect this show. It's something in China. Like it was such a bizarre thing to me. And lo and behold, the world shut down around 10 days before we were going to shoot the show. So at one point, I wasn't sure it was ever going to happen. And then luckily, we'd actually already made the announcement. So therefore, there was pressure on all of us to still do it. And fast forward 13 months later, we finally shot it in April 2021. And actually, that time was very useful. I actually think that time made the show much better because I was a Friends fan, but I wasn't like an expert. I hadn't seen every show. I hadn't seen every episode. My wife had, but I hadn't. I loved it. I thought it was really clever and smart. But I used that lockdown period and that extra 13 months. I watched every episode. I read a couple of books about the history of Friends. I got to know the cast a lot better. I spent time with them either on Zoom or in person when it was safe to do so. And I think the show became deeper and more informed because I was able to essentially study the show for a year so that when the time came in April for me to make it, I couldn't have been more ready. I knew exactly what I needed. You know, in conversations, Schwimmer had mentioned that he had fancied Jennifer in the early days, and Jen had mentioned it was reciprocal, and I suddenly was able to bring that up, whereas a year before I wouldn't have known them well enough to bring that up. Little things like that that I think made the show so much stronger. And I'm told it was a huge hit for HBO Max, although they never give me their results. But I know it was the most watched show in the history of Sky One in the UK. I know that. So I'm pleased with it. And I hope we didn't let the fans down. And I hope we did a good job for people who Friends mean so much for.
I don't think you did let the fans down at all. Now, Full Well, which is where it all started in 2007, when you, I think the first thing you produced was Hand of the Gods.
Yeah, that's right, In the Hands of the Gods, yeah.
And the shows that you have produced and directed are like a who's who of TV royalty. And if my calculations are correct, Ben Winston, you're 40 next month, and I don't think I've got the gig, have I? Don't tell me you're having a party and you are not flying out Liz Taylor to produce it.
I'm having two parties. I'm having a 40th birthday party around one of my closest friends out in America is a guy called Maverick Carter. And Mav is an amazing producer and he's LeBron James's partner. He's absolute terrific guy. And we, 7 years ago, when we were set up on a blind date together by a friend that we have in common, the friend Tom said, you two are going to love each other. You're going to get on so well. He was one of the first people I made friends with when I was out in LA. And on our first dinner, we worked out that we were born 2 days apart. And so we made a joke that if we're still friends in 6 years or whatever it was, we'll have a joint 40th. And we are still friends, luckily, in 6 years. So we're having a joint 40th. But it's in Malibu and it's in a couple of weeks. And sadly, what's sad about it is actually none of my mates can come because America is still closed its borders. So six of my best mates were going to fly in and we were going to have a really lovely LA weekend. And now, sadly, you know, my close mates aren't going to be able to be there. And even James, my best mate, can't be here because he's going away that week. So yeah, I'm not sure about that one. I think I'll just turn into a few drinks in Malibu. So I don't think it's a Liz Taylor affair. And then I might do another party in December for all my UK mates. For me and my wife, we might have a joint 40th in December. Because we're not really going to do a huge amount out here for either of our birthdays.
You actually bypassed that very, very well, because I don't know whether I've got the gig or not. But even if I haven't got the gig, we'll still remain friends, Ben, because I'm in total awe of you.
You're very lovely.
What is the next thing on Ben Winston's bucket list? Where are we going from here?
I've got two quite big shows that I'm working on, which we haven't announced either. Both are with two high-profile talents, and we'll announce those in the next few weeks, which I'm excited about both. They're both very different, but they're both hopefully going to do okay. And they'll be exciting announcements. You know what? I never really think 2 or 3 years ahead. I've always decided not to, because I don't think it benefits me. I think what I do is I just look at things as we go and every year just make sure, okay, I'm doing stuff that I like, stuff that I believe in, stuff that I care about. And I try not to overthink where I'm going or what I'm doing, because I think that that's unproductive for me. I think I've just got to make whatever's in front of me really good and the next thing will come along. And just make sure I always get the balance right between work and my family. I think, you know, I said this earlier when I was talking about my dad, but it's very important to me that I make sure I don't neglect family time when work that I do can in my brain just become too self-important. And I think it's always really important to check yourself and go, look, it may be a Friends reunion or the Grammys or James or whatever, but actually the most important thing is Ruby and Grace, my two kids, and making sure that they're happy and secure and healthy. And, you know, I think about that quite a lot as I hit 40, for sure.
Well, on that note, if I don't get the 40th, put me down for the bat mitzvahs, please.
Okay.
I'll fly out to LA. Ben, thank you so, so much. Have a lot of fun and enjoy the journey, because I think that you've got a long, long way to go and I think you're going to have an amazing time. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Nice chatting to you.
I think the one thing that I learned from Ben and actually acknowledge is that he has remained true to his roots and his feet are firmly on the ground. Please listen to my air extension after this podcast. This week's title is Roots. If you want to find out how your business can thrive with my support, head to my website, liz-taylor-consulting.co.uk, and you can find my book there, Tailor Made. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast wherever it is you listen. Hear the next episode of Events That Made Me, The Entrepreneur's Edit, on the 23rd of December.